Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Yeah, hey, hi, hi. Can you understand me? You picked a really shitty time to attack us. I'm not saying it's your fault. I mean, it is, but the timing, it's not good. I'm dealing with a lot here with the Shadow King. And, well, this isn't helping. So, I was hoping you could appreciate my situation and maybe, I don't know, be on your way. Go back to where you came from. Otherwise, I have to kill you. Are you understanding this? I guess not.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Jason.
And I'm Rima.
This is Legion Cast episode 15.
Yay, 15.
I didn't like this one as much when I first saw it.
Why not? Or you want to wait to talk about it?
Yeah, I guess let's just get into it. So it's our top five highlights for Legion season 2, episode 7, chapter 15. I don't know. Well, I do. I think I know, but part of it is the last three episodes were just so good.
Mm-hmm.
What was the one that was... Okay, well, last week was the one where he went to the multiple
all the realities. Davids.
And then the one before that was where Amy died. You remember Lenny showed up and they were trying to figure out if she was really Lenny or what the hell was going on with her?
Yeah, I mean, there was the whole interrogation of Lenny. We had Clark and then mm-hmm. Potonomy and then David all going in to talk to Lenny. And then we had the interaction between Farouk and Oliver. Oliver's like, you know, I'm going to kill you, you know, had that those good lines. And then we had what happened to Amy.
Yeah.
And yeah. Lenny coming back.
Yeah. So I guess one of the reasons why I couldn't remember it so well is because that was my least favorite of the last three, but it was still, I thought, really good. And then the one before that was where he went into Sid's mind, which I think is still maybe my favorite of the whole series. And so when we got into this one, I was just left feeling kind of wowed after all three of those. And I wasn't left feeling that way after this one. And I'd just kind of gotten used to being like that. So I was like, I don't know. But then after the second time through and thinking about it, I found a lot to like. So why don't we get into it? What did you think?
Okay. Well, it wasn't one of my favorite episodes, and I didn't come away with a strong feeling like I had been, like you said, with the last several episodes, you know, the one where we were in, Sid's mind, and then, you know, the episode where Amy died and Lenny came back with everything that happened. It was so emotional, and it really, you know, left some feelings behind on that one. And then, of course, the last one was so great. And just, I mean, it was sad, but it was really great. This one didn't wow me as the others, but I think I liked it better on the second watch, but I'm still just feeling left. I feel like it's just kind of dragging just a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
There were a couple things that kind of moved the plot forward, but it just kind of, you know, the whole, and that goes, like, my number five is the part where David calls out Farouk. It's kind of at a point where I'm kind of getting a little tired of these two mm-hmm. kind of sitting, you know, in the astral plane, and Farouk challenges David, you know, he's trying to get him on his side, find my body, blah blah blah. He's trying to make David into who Farouk thinks he should be, you know, homo superior. Yeah, and then David keeps rejecting
him.
We've
seen all this.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, and I like how they keep dressing the scene. They keep putting us in these interesting places, you know, but it's not enough to keep me interested.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that it's starting to kind of wear me out just a little bit. So
yeah.
I hope that we can kind of move forward with that just a little bit. So I think, you know, and that's, like I said, my number five. And that's probably the part that kind of brought it down for me a little bit.
Yeah, I almost wonder if Noah Hawley thinks, oh man, this is really complicated, and I'm sure people are going to be lost, so I'm just going to have an episode where we remind people of things, because it felt like those things that you just said, and even at the end when who's the narrator guy? Jon
John
Hamm.
Hamm.
He just reminds us of all the concepts that they've kind of gives a quick summary of all the concepts that he's been going over in the last several episodes. And so it felt like a refresher, like when you're in school and you have a review unit or something. And it's like, no, I don't want that. Like, especially we're doing this podcast. We've
Yeah, here's a
studied the
summary
hell
of what
out of
we've
these.
learned.
We've like watched every episode twice. Give us new. I want novelty. Yeah, well, my number five is Bad Feelings. And there were a few things that left me feeling kind of blah. Amal calls David on his true feelings for his sister and says, David, you hated her and you wished her dead. Did we ever see that? I don't think we did, right?
I don't remember hearing any thoughts of that from season one. I don't remember
That's where you
him
would think
being
it would be.
hostile.
Yeah, even when he goes to live with her, and he always seems to love her. Even when she comes to visit, there's no sense of any resentment there.
No, I didn't pick up on any of that. When she came to see him in the first episode of season one, she's giving him the birthday cake, and I mean, he's kind of down,
Yeah,
obviously
he
because
looks
of
a
his
little depressed,
circumstances, but he
but
doesn't seem resentful towards her. He doesn't seem angry towards
yeah.
her when he goes to live with her once he gets out. Like you said, she seemed more almost scared of him. When she, he kind of has his little mental break for a second, and that lamp gets broken, and she comes downstairs to check on him, and he's like, "Oh yeah, everything's fine." And she's kind of like, "Okay," and she starts hiding the
Right.
garden tools, the sharp instruments, and stuff away
Yeah, that
from
seemed
him.
like a
So,
little bit of a retcon, because we saw, she took him to the asylum and said that he would just be there for a few weeks, and it ended up being 6 years. And so it would make sense that he'd have some resentment, and maybe, okay, fine, we didn't see it, but it was there, or whatever. But that little details like that that don't feel true kind of bug me. There's repetitiveness that you're talking about with David and Farouk facing off. I did like David just growling at him.
yeah.
So there's little funny
Use your
moments.
words.
Yeah. And Farouk tells him to take off his mask and come to the big kids table and all this, that we already saw that a couple weeks ago. He just says, do what you want, take what you want. Gods make rules, they don't follow them. Yeah, we already heard all that. Even he Farouk complains about these heroes with their blue eyes, and he feels like he's persecuted by white men, and we know that already. I was kind of annoyed with both Sids, future Sid and current Sid. The whole scene of Sid saying, oh, you should ask my future self what did she want to know, like what he
Like what
made
she
of
thought.
Farouk, what he was doing. And he's like, well, doesn't it bother you? I don't want you to be jealous. And at first I thought David was sort of bringing that up when it wasn't even there. But then again, I know sometimes with couples, like if one of the people are jealous, they don't want to seem jealous, so they actually offer up. No, go ahead. Why don't you go see the person? It's fine. Or it can even be a test, like to see how the other person will respond, And so it felt kind of real, but I don't know. After how solid they were after that episode where he goes and explores her psyche, this felt like a step back, which is fine. I mean, there's back and forth in couples, but just the whole thing of the jealousy isn't nice. It's not a nice feeling. And then future Sid, she's not being very compassionate about David having lost his sister. You got to focus. But then again, she's in an apocalypse. We haven't gotten to experience that or see it, but she probably lost billions of people. So it kind of makes sense. It's just felt kind of dismissive, and she's always been a little cold towards him because, as we know for sure now, he turns into a bad guy. But then all of a sudden she turns around and wants to kiss him, which felt kind of like soap opera-ish, like, oh, David just had a conversation about jealousy with current day Sid, so we have to have future Sid make a pass at him so he can kind of cheat, which also felt bad. Like, oh, he's cheat. He said he wasn't going to do it, and he promised, and then it didn't even take very much. And now they're kissing. Like, he didn't even really try to resist it.
Well, it's still Sydney, and his Sydney, and I think that I know that she was acting kind of cold and harsh towards him, and I think I understand why a little bit. I mean, I think she's probably, in a way, if David is who they're saying is going to bring about this apocalypse that she keeps talking about, then she's probably scared of him. Doesn't, you know, remember, like, she probably feels a little scared to kind of put herself out there, that she's seeing her old David. This is her David that she remembers, not the one, you know, she didn't know that David that I guess is the one that's, we're assuming anyway, to be the one to bring about the apocalypse. And I think that she's probably trying to, you know, hold her feelings back, I think. And that's why she's being a little bit more cold to sit. And I also think she's had longer to sit with it. The fact that Amy died, you know, she's like, you know, and she sees it as a distraction. It's like what current Sid is telling him, you know, he's trying to use it as a distraction to make you emotional, you know, and to break you. And you need, you know, you need to focus. And that's what future Sid tells him, is you need to focus. And I think she's had more time to sit with it. It's still fresh with David, and it probably does seem cold.
It's a little unclear, because she had that conversation with Farouk, and he said, you know, why don't we work together? Basically, we can rule the world. I mean, save the world from David. It's exactly what she's been wanting anyway. She wanted David to help Farouk get his body back so that he could stop David. And so now here comes Farouk right at her doorstep offering to help. That's what she wanted. So I think it makes sense that they are a team now. And then the next thing you know, David comes to visit her. And so I wondered if, because that was a pretty abrupt change of emotion from her, that maybe it was some kind of a ploy. I don't know. I mean, I could also see, because she did that right when David was going to leave. And then she said, well, can we say goodbye? So it's hard to tell. I mean, I'm a little confused about the emotions in this whole thing, and where people are with each other, because they just kind of left Farouk and Sid in the middle of their conversation.
Yep.
And then I was wondering, well, if that was a goodbye, because the reason why David went to talk to her was to say, I don't want to help Farouk anymore. He killed my sister. And then she's like, okay, then you could just go, and it's too much. And that felt a little passive aggressive to me. he did go. So maybe he decided he's not going to help Farouk. That's not clear either.
I think that can be taken both ways.
Yeah, it could be either way, but we're not clear. I mean, before Farouk killed Amy, David was pretty clear, was trying to help him find his body. And now I don't think he is trying to help him anymore, but I'm not sure. I guess we'll find out next week. Sid, Batonomy, Carrie, and Clark are in the elevator panicking about Fukuyama. They're paranoid and they think he's going to eat them and all this. And that was kind of uncomfortable. I mean, that's okay. Actually, what I kind of realized after I was done the first time watching this and not liking it, and then I was watching it a second time, is this episode is filled with a lot of uncomfortable emotions. There's paranoia, betrayal, fear, uncertainty, disconnection between characters that we like to see together, panic. And one thing about Legion, normally, like especially in the first season, it kind of gives you the feeling of what it's like to be schizophrenic. You feel crazy. This episode gives you the feeling of what it's like to be panicked and jealous and, you know, all these negative feelings that they're exploring. And I think that part of my negative reaction is just, those aren't nice feelings to have, you know? And if you're dropped in the middle of it, it's like, ugh, I don't like this. But if I take a step back, I wouldn't want every episode to be this way, but I kind of appreciate it, because I think most shows, they have their tone and they kind of repeat it every week. And you get similar feelings. If you're watching a comedy, you get to laugh. If you're watching Walking Dead, you get to feel like afraid for the characters. With Legion, it takes you on a roller coaster ride of craziness.
Absolutely.
And it's different kinds of crazy. And this week it was a lot of things that, you know, there's jealousy in my life. Sometimes there's paranoia and fear and betrayal. And I hate all that stuff when it happens to me, so it's not comfortable to feel. But as long as it's not like this every week, I can kind of appreciate it being like this for 1 week, I think. I don't know. What do you think of all that I just said?
I think that you're right. I mean, there's bad feelings, but I think that's what probably makes some of this kind of relatable. I mean, there are bad feelings in life. You know, there are all of those types of emotions that, you know, all of us one way or another, on every, you know, piece of the spectrum there probably felt, as far as, you know, paranoia and betrayal and jealousy. And jealousy doesn't always have to be negative. No. I think it started out as, you know, a little bit positive and then kind of went a little negative in this episode, but it doesn't always have to be a negative.
I mean, especially they made those ground rules, and that's like, that's nice. You can help each other feel safe. And then he broke the ground rules, and it doesn't matter that it's Sid. I mean, that was what the ground rules were established in, the knowledge that he's going to see future Sid. And then he still broke them. Right. Cause what was the rule that.
Like if she needs a hug.
Yeah.
Like a comforting hug. So then
they're making out. I think that was pretty clearly not what Sid had in mind.
But I think the ground, and I'm not justifying behavior because I'm not saying it was okay for him to break the rules. But I think that if this was like their goodbye, like they're not going to see each other anymore, I think the ground rules are established from, if you continue to see her and visit her, this is what the ground rules are. But I think that maybe
I see
because
how your
this
mind
was,
works.
If you're never going to
see
her
again. You can rationalize a makeout session as long as.
Okay.
Got it.
Anyway.
Anyway, what's your number four?
My number four is Potonomy. And I think that it was interesting to see him, you know, how this delusional egg kind of got like reawakened within him, and how, you know, we got that really creepy scene of the Vermilion coming up under the sheets. That really creeped the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. And it woke up inside of him, caused him to go around planting those delusion eggs like around everyone else and getting everyone infected. And then we see him at the end, you know, we get all that stuff in the middle where he's fighting with Carrie and stuff. We don't get to see him a whole lot in the episode, but then we see him at the end with that creepy delusion creature. I don't know, call them chickens or just whatever the hell you want to call them, those tar covered creatures. Essentially like just crawls out of him and essentially kills him. I thought it was more of like, you know, how when David pops that creature out of Sid and Clark's foreheads, it seemed to be in a psychic manner, but this thing seemed to like physically crawl out of him, not like psychically.
I thought maybe it was just about how long it had been gestating that it had grown so much that it had a physical impact, whereas those other ones just got into them the night before, so he could pull them out without any physical impact, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, clearly this thing was with him longer, because we saw him get infected, you know, many, many episodes ago. Mm-hmm. And so this thing has obviously had time to incubate a lot longer than the others, so they've done less damage. But it looked like it really left a physical, like it looked like he had some visible, like it tore through his spine and his back what it looked like.
I mean, they said we can save his mind, which suggests that his body's gone. Or, I mean, now it's fused to this computer / tree. But I think if they hadn't done something, he would have just been dead.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree that it was killing him, whatever it was. And that's why I thought it was interesting that this seemed to be more of a physical thing for him than it was like psychic for like the others, because it had more time to incubate and become more of a part of him.
I think it was both, because I actually don't think the Vermilion were in his bed. I could be wrong. Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong. But I think the whole point is that this thing was causing them to have delusions, and that it was turning them against Fukuyama and the Vermilion, making them think that they were bad, even though they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that it was real. I just know it was creepy as
hell. Yeah, it really was.
You know, whether it was real or not, it was just the whole vision of her crawling up through the sheets that way was creepy as hell. And then the one Vermilion that was standing outside of that cafeteria that they were standing at, and she just stops and looks around and just smiles. It was like, oh,
it was like the worst attempt at a smile.
Yeah, it was horrible. But I just think that it was sad, because Ptolemy, I felt, was a real... I don't think we've seen the last of him. I don't. I just feel that he was really underdeveloped, and we didn't get to see him very much this season, and I think he could be a really interesting character and do a lot with him, and I don't know where they're going to move forward. And I think in Legion, no one is really dead. When they say that they're dead, clearly his mind is living on. I don't know what that means in this... in this mainframe and with this creepy Matrix grandma that is shushing him. But anyway,
I don't know if she's creepy.
I thought she was kind of creepy.
I thought it was weird that she was there, but
I found her creepy. That was just me though. But
I found her comforting.
No, not comforting. No knitting, no creepy grandma shushing me. So
yeah, I want to get to know him more, and I hope that this is actually the jumping off point for more focus on him, even though his body seems to be incapacitated, because I like the actor, and I think what we've seen of him, especially in season one, was really interesting, and I feel like he's getting the short shrift right now.
Yeah, it's a shame.
But maybe not, you know, maybe now, I mean, it does seem like they're not saying, okay, we're shunting him aside, because especially with the creepy grandma, it's like, oh, there's something up there. So maybe they'll explore it later.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he's gone. It's just, it's a shame that what we've seen so far, he's just, I don't think we've seen his full potential, but I think that's happening with a lot of characters this season.
Yeah. Like Melanie, I almost wonder if that actress left the show or something. We haven't even seen her.
I know. Well, we saw just a flash of her as Fukuyami's kind of doing his little slideshow of what's happening, you know, in D3, and you see, you know, what's happening. You see this flash of her, but that's all that you see is like, it looks like she's drinking, I don't know if it's water or vodka, whatever she's drinking from a glass.
They're like, we only need you in for 5 minutes this week.
Yeah.
Lay on the bed and take a drink.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, my number four is this delusion monster parasite thing. We first saw that in one of the John Hamm little instructional educational things, and it seemed to be a metaphor for what happens when, how delusions form. You have this thought that gets perverted and in isolation and whatever, and then we saw them manifest on the psychic space. Sometimes you'd see them, but also in the real world. Like, yeah, the one crawled into Ptolemy's room. And did we see it go into his ear? Maybe. I don't know. And it wasn't clear if it was still a metaphor or an actual creature or some combination, like a creature that's some kind of mutant manifestation for delusion or a cause of delusional thoughts. Well, I think it is. I think it's an actual creature that gives you delusional thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know where it came from. I don't think it has anything to do with Farouk, because Vermilion, one of the Vermilion, said traitors working in service of the Shadow King. David said, no, it's something else. So at least he thinks it's not related to Farouk. And well, at least in the comics, you get villains showing up from all over the place. So it makes sense that they don't all have to be related. Yeah, I think this thing was poisoning them against Vermilion and Fukuyama. I think it was making them, because now, you know, remember, I forget how this came about, but in one episode we saw inside Fukuyama's mask, and it was, I think it was that creature, just a big one going,
yeah, because we saw it again in this one too.
Yeah,
making them think that he was evil and turning against him. And
yeah, so I think that was all just a delusion, and that it was kind of cool actually that they made him take his mask off, and he's just a Japanese guy who, that's what you would expect. Mm-hmm. He has one of those neck head brace things on. It's called a halo brace. And so I think the creature part of that was just a hallucination, and that all the stuff where they're paranoid about him was just a manifestation of what that delusion monster did to them. And then I really, really, I think probably my favorite scene, played a clip from it at the beginning of this episode, was when David pulls it aside somehow, maybe into the psychic space or whatever, and tries to reason with it. Can you just go home? Like, I'm dealing with some other stuff right now. And it's like, rah!
it was a really great scene.
All right, I'm going to have to kill you. I told, you know, remember, I was going to let you go. And then you just, and I loved how he just made himself bigger and that was
it
really
got smaller.
Creative. Yeah. So that was great. And I wonder if that's it. Like, okay, we're done with that thing. I kind of hope so. We never find out where it came from. That would be fine with me.
Well, I guess it would be okay to not know, but it makes me wonder if because we hear Sydney tell Lenny that she's just a distraction, that what Farouk has done to her by killing Amy and bringing Lenny back is some sort of distraction to maybe throw David off balance. I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes me wonder if this whole delusion thing is also supposed to serve as some sort of distraction, and it doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily come from Farouk, but is there another, like you said, villains can kind of come out of nowhere from the comics. You know, it's not just all about one villain. There's lots of villains that just kind of pop in and out of anywhere. So is this going to introduce some other type of villain or source threat that we don't yet know about outside of Farouk? Because Farouk is all we've known since season one. Are they trying to somehow introduce another threat right now? And I mean, maybe they won't explain it. Maybe there's not. It was just a question that I had, that maybe it was a distraction, but a distraction from what and for what purpose and from who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could just be some kind of interdimensional being came to our world somehow, tried to fuck with everybody,
wanted to stir some shit
David
up.
David smashed them and defeated them. Yeah, I mean, in the comics, that, you know, there's every month there's a new threat, so it could be
possible.
All right, what's your number three?
My number three is David and the Two Sydneys. And we've talked a little bit about it already, but some things that I was, you know, kind of observing while I'm watching. And we talked a little bit about, you know, Sid being upset, you know, when they're in bed, and she is upset that David won't talk to her and open up to her about what happened to Amy. You know, and I kind of see both sides. You know, she wants to get him to, you know, try to communicate and talk about it. And I think for him, it's still too fresh. He's still too traumatized, hasn't had time to really process exactly what happened. And maybe that's why he isn't ready yet to talk to her about it. She, of course, suggests talking to future Sid. He's surprised by it. And, you know, he's thinking, you know, I'm wondering, is it just a passing thought? Like, is she just kind of upset that he's not talking to her? So she's like, well, why don't you just go talk to future Sid about it?
Yeah, if you're not going to talk to me, that's what she said. So that was where there was a little edge to it.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay, did she really mean that? Or is she just kind of saying it because she's upset that he won't talk to her? So she's like, well, fine, if you won't talk to me, maybe you'll go talk to her. And then he seems kind of surprised by it. And then when he's like, what, you're okay with that? She's like, why wouldn't I be okay with that?
Yeah, it's like, why do you even need to ask that? Like, that
like
kind of
me.
Stoked it. Like,
yeah, he's almost fanning the fire a little bit.
Yeah, like, why would you think I'm jealous? Should I be jealous? And then she goes, are you physical with her? And he doesn't answer. And she's like, David.
Yeah, I think he did not make the situation any better. So, I mean, she might have been a little bit jealous, but I think that she wasn't jealous until he said something.
I think she might have been a little, but yeah, it really
fanned
it.
She did not look very jealous to me, because she's like, what, jealous? Why am I jealous of myself?
She did say, if you're not going to talk to me. So that felt like it had a little edge. I think fanning the flame is a good metaphor. Like, maybe she was a little matchstick worth jealous, and then he turned it into a big bonfire.
Yeah, I think he kind of made it worse. I do like, though, that how they both kind of acknowledge that it's weird. Their whole situation, and that there's no handbook for that type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that they were willing to have like a real human moment and actually at least communicate about it, that they were, able to set some ground rules that, you know, okay, if we're going to deal with this and this is what it's going to be, then let's have some ground rules. And I like in one way that they're having this, it's like a strategy session, since they're the only two that know David is visiting a future Sydney and this messed up future. But it turns into this conversation between a boyfriend and his jealous girlfriend.
Yeah.
And they lay down these ground rules for the visits. And
it's what Noah Hawley does so well, is figure out how to find out how real people would respond to these weird situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he does that really well. So I like that they get to that point, and then, you know, they come to a conclusion. They set the ground rules. They're okay with it, and they start. You know, Sydney closes her eyes, and David tells Sydney he loves her, and she doesn't respond. And David's like, "Are you gonna say it too?" And she just kind of whispers, "Shut up."
It seems like they're getting past the honeymoon phase here.
A little bit, but then she says, "I love you." Yeah. And it was a sweet moment.
She meant it, you could tell.
She meant it. And it reminds me of the moment in season one when Sydney was helping get David out of D3 and that big battle that was happening, that super cool battle that we got in season one, in episode one. And she says the same to him. They're getting ready to get on this boat and all of them are down there rescuing him, Melanie and Potonomy, and all of them are down there. And she, because he's kind of freaking out, and he goes, "Are you real?" And she says, "I'm real. This is real, okay? I'm here. I came back for you." She says, "I love you." And she says, "Okay." And he goes, "Okay." And there's like a pause, and she says, "You gonna say it too?" And he goes, "I love you." Mm. So it kind of goes back to season
I like
one.
Call back.
Yeah, sweet little callback to that moment. I think it was also a good reminder that people need to hear the words. You know, when you love someone, you should tell them. Even if you know the person loves you, you know, through actions, I think words are important too. And you can tell that David needed to hear it. You know, he smiled when he looked at her. I think it was important in that moment for it to be said between them. So I thought that was super sweet. So we get that sweet moment between current Sydney and David. And then with future Sydney, we've talked a little bit about her. I wonder if it was a little bit of a reverse psychology move for her to say that she asked too much of him. When he says that he can't help Brooke anymore, she does ask for the goodbye. David is, of course, instantly breaking the rules that he set with current Sid. And, you know, she tells him just live and make good choices. And I wonder if she truly meant that or if that was a reverse psychology move.
It sounded very much like passive aggressive reverse psychology to me. Okay, fine. It's too much to ask you to help me with my little apocalypse. I understand.
I don't know. I can see it both ways. I can see it both ways. It just makes me wonder.
The way she played it to me seemed like.
Man, you are critical of the women.
Yeah, this week I feel pretty critical, especially of future Sid. Like, I can definitely understand current Sid being jealous, because that would be totally weird, especially the way David handled it. So I'm not really feeling critical of that. I presented it in my number five as feeling critical because it was an uncomfortable feeling, but I realized later that that's kind of what the episode was going for. But I really, did think that future Sid was being passive aggressive with David, and David's all kinds of fucked up. So I'm not just like blaming everything on her, but in that one instance, I didn't like that.
David is all kind of fucked up, but he was about the most sane one in this episode. Yep.
All right,
so that was my number three.
Okay, my number three is, where is it, trying to figure out what Farouk is doing, because he killed Amy, and I still don't really understand why he did that when David was already trying to help him find his body. I mean, on one hand, I'm like, come on, David, you're all powerful. Why is it taking you so long to do this? But still, he was on his side. And now that Farouk did that, he's at war with Farouk, and he doesn't want to help him anymore. And he's said he's not going to help him. And so now Farouk is provoking him by saying, oh, you didn't like your sister anyway, and she put you in an asylum like a crazy person. And I'm like, you're the one who made him crazy. You were a passenger in his body, and you fucked with him for his whole life. And then telling him, you know, sending him to the kiddie table, which I actually thought was pretty funny.
It was funny.
All of a sudden he's at the kiddie table, and the kids are even dismissive of him. Who's this? Ignore him, and maybe he'll leave. Then tries to turn him against his sister. She laughed at you. David the dancing bear, and then I assume Shadow King creates an image of her, and she's laughing at him. Oh, don't laugh at me. And so he's totally provoking him. I wonder how much there is to that about trying to make him take off his mask, manifest his full power. Is that the whole point of this? Trying to bring out David's full potential for some reason? Why?
That's the only way it makes sense for me. I don't know that that is the answer, but is the only thing that makes sense to me as to why he would provoke David in the way, because David is supposed to be a very powerful mutant capable of some big time, like worldwide destruction. And why would he try to bring him to his side, help, you know, I need your help to find my body. Why would he in turn try to turn David away from him or not want to help him by killing his sister? And I can only think that he's trying to bring that out into David. He keeps telling David to rise above. Gods don't follow the rules, we make the rules. This is something repetitive that we keep hearing over and over again. And he keeps throwing out these challenges to him. And I think he wants David to rise above. And David has chosen, now he's very angry, yes, but it hasn't brought, I think, his full potential out in him. No. And that's, I think, for some reason what he's trying to do, but I'm not sure why he's trying to do that.
I mean, I still also do think that probably or possibly he wants to use that device so that he can be inside David's body. So maybe he's trying to make David manifest his full powers and then jump into his fully powerful body. I don't know.
But you would think that Farouk could somehow, you know, just because those powers are within David and in his DNA, that he would be able to manifest those himself if he's inhabiting his body fully.
Who knows
the
how
same
it works,
as what Lenny is.
Possible,
I don't know either. Yeah. Well, but that's what they kind of imply a little bit with Farouk. Farouk, even just as a mind, as this physical or this psychic being without his mind, he's very powerful. But they said that with his body, he's going to be very almost unstoppable because the mutation is within his DNA. So he'll be even more powerful with his body. And that's what, of course, they're trying to prevent by him pairing up with his body. And, you know, by using David's body, he would have all of these powers. And I don't know that he needs David to manifest them before he wants his body to overtake it.
Yeah. The only thing that makes me think he might need David to manifest them is because he's provoking him so much and trying to get him to come into his full power. That's the only reason why I think that might be a possibility. Otherwise, why kill his sister when he's already helping you, you know? Mm-hmm. If what you're saying is right, that he could just go into his body no matter what David's mindset is, then why do all this? So there could be some other reason for it.
Maybe it makes him more unstable. Maybe if it, like the comics, where he's a little bit more multiple personalities and a little bit off balance, maybe him not being as calm and settled as he is right now, where he does have some pretty strong powers. We got to see some of those powers again this episode and see him use them. But maybe he seems a little more calm and centered. Maybe by manifesting all of these great powers that he has, he becomes a little bit more off balance and unsettled and easier to take over or something. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe he's easier. Yeah, he's like his defenses are down or his integrity is not as strong or something like that.
Yeah.
So then I don't remember if I'm missing something, but I don't know how Shadow King knows that David has been communicating with future Sid. Did we see that?
I would have to go back. I thought that it was mentioned somehow in reference.
It seems like it must have been, but because he does know, and that's the whole point of him creating this like time machine car, psychic time machine, where
point
he's
operated,
like routing this green or pink glowing fluid from one end of the car to the other, which look like what you do if you're going to kill yourself. You like route the exhaust into the cabin. But anyway, so then he goes to see future Sid, and that was interesting because what was really interesting is I think he went just to find out why David was helping her and trying to help him. And he didn't even know until that moment that David in the future becomes the uber villain that destroys the world. And he finds out. And I like that. And he's really tickled by it. Oh my God, they call me the villain. And look at this.
He seems quite pleased. He doesn't seem to mind at all that there's...
He got killed.
Like, oh, by the way, you're dead. And he's like, whatever.
And his logic doesn't make any sense. He says, you know, when someone dies and they don't have any heirs, the state gets their belongings because the state's the one who wrote the law, and it's It's rigged. The rules are rigged for the state, and I'm the state, baby, or whatever he said.
Even
and
when like, I lose,
yeah,
I
but
win.
You're, yeah, but if you're dead, then you know you're gonna be dead.
but he's not, because he still psychically is living on. His mind is still living even without his body. So
he's just Mr. Confident and cool, no matter what.
Well, he seems so fascinated about just David and his potential, like this, mm-hmm. and him reaching this potential. He seems more excited about that than worried about, oh, David killed me. Okay.
You know? Which is cool, because he did spend a lot of time with David, years and years and years. So it's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so then he finds that out, and it looks like he tries to strike a deal with future Sid, and I assume that she said yes to that, because, like I said, she's been trying to get David to help Farouk get his body back so he can stop David. So now if she has access to Farouk, she can try and make that happen even more effectively, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
What's your number two?
Well, my number two, you covered a lot of what was already in my number two, and that was Farouk meets future Sid. I really like this whole interaction between them, and the only few things that I'll add, I really liked the intrigue about Farouk, about he just didn't seem fazed at all about the possibility of being killed. He seems more interested in David becoming the supervillain. I like how he, you know, is going around saying the villain is the hero and the villain... or the hero is the villain, you know, talking about David, who's the hero, who becomes the villain, Farouk, who everyone for centuries have called him the villain, and now he's the hero that needs to save everyone from this impending apocalypse that future Sidney is talking about. So I thought that was cool.
And Sid says maybe we're all villains, and I think, if anything, that's closer to the truth, because David is so potentially unstable, and we've seen him do some pretty horrific things in this series, but I don't care... What up till now, I would never see Farouk as a hero.
No, but he doesn't see himself as a villain. We've had that conversation before, and I'm not saying that he is a hero or he's not a villain, but he doesn't see himself as a villain. So
yeah, but in this episode, he actually referred to people as ants, which is mm-hmm. how I don't think he'd done that before, but that's how I describe him. He may not see himself as a villain, but he sees everyone else as ants that he can just smash, and they don't matter. So that's a villain.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He's definitely. There's no question that he is a villain. He just doesn't see himself that way. You know, he thinks himself as a god. He's all powerful. Right. Yeah. He's homo superior. You know. Yeah. And we've established that he just doesn't see himself that way.
Not necessarily. He sees himself as a victim too. Oh, they're coming after me.
Right. Like he's been oppressed. You know, by everyone. But I really just enjoyed this whole scene, because it's the first time that we've gotten to see this actor and Farouk interact with someone other than Oliver and Lenny. And while all of those scenes are always really great, I think all of these actors have some really great chemistry. It was great to see him interact with someone other than Oliver and Lenny and David. Sorry, I know he's interacted with David as well. So it was cool to see the scene between them two. I think that both actors had really great chemistry together as they're talking and they're kind of circling around that chair, and they're only both saying as much as what they need to each other. They're both being manipulative. They're both being manipulative. They're both being clever and only saying things that as much as what they need to the other. And so I just really liked that scene with them. And it was interesting to see Farouk with someone other than Oliver, Lenny, or David. So, and I thought it worked really well between them too. So that was only what I wanted to say, in addition to what you had already mentioned about those two together.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. This isn't a criticism of the show, but it bothers me to see a guy who I know is not a good person have some kind of psychological or emotional effect on a good person. And especially when it's a man and a woman, and you could tell that she was intimidated by him, I guess. And maybe, I don't know, do you think she was a little turned on or not really when he touched her?
I don't think she was turned on at all. I think I felt that she was
scared
internally. I think she was scared, but she was probably, I think, internally squirming.
Okay.
But I think she was scared of him.
I feel ashamed I even thought that at all. I mean, I didn't think it for sure, but I kind of wondered a little bit.
I think so much of this show is open for interpretation. No, I'm not saying that you're wrong for feeling that or anything or thinking that, but I didn't get that from her at all. I think that she was trying to put on a brave face.
Yeah. And she needs him.
Yeah, she does need him. So I didn't pick
up on
that.
But he did, even if there was no turn on there, definitely he had the way he has such command of the situation and confidence and swagger. That
he's very charismatic.
He could be a cult leader, yeah, and I think that definitely had an effect on her, and it was great to watch how it played out.
Well, we don't know that they had any type of, I mean, because she told David that he killed Farouk a week from when he first met Future Sid, and they were talking. She's like, "You kill Farouk like a week from now." So we don't know that she's had any type of interaction with him before. That I mean, in within that week before he killed Farouk, you know, so this could be the very first time that she's ever met him.
I think so,
and,
yeah.
You know, and she was probably very much intimidated because he is still a very powerful mutant on his own right and, you know, clearly a villain, and she should be scared, but I think that she was trying to put on a brave face, a brave front. Mm-hmm. So that's just how I got that whole situation. But he is very charismatic. I mean, villain or not, he's very smooth, very charismatic, and, you know, I think has a way of trying to bring people to his side. He's got a good argument, or he thinks is a good argument.
Yeah, I don't see myself falling for that ever. No matter how charismatic you are, but who knows if you're in the middle of it. Okay, my number two is two. Moral Panic, which is this week's John Hamm narration. He says, moral panic is defined as public anxiety or alarm in response to a perceived threat to the moral standards of society. The road to moral panic has several stops. The first is concern. This concern, limited at first, spreads from person to person, amplified by cultural forces until rational concern becomes irrational fear. People come to believe something terrible is happening, something they cannot see, that they can't control. It has come for others. It will come for them. Whether or not the threat is real, the response certainly is, and it's often excessive. And then you see the witch get hanged right at that moment. And then he goes, ask yourself, what's more terrifying? Fear? And then you see all those villagers who had been looking at the witch, and then he goes, or the frightened, and then they look at you, the viewer, as if you were next. And personally, I just love that whole message because I agree. I think that people often are too quick to just jump on the bandwagon when they're afraid and judge things or not approach a situation with an open eyes and open heart and to see what's actually there, but instead to put it through this filter of cultural fears and stuff like that and just come to it closed and shut off and from a place of fear and then want to shut stuff down or whatever. But so I'm like kind of a sucker for Noah Hawley's message. I could tell that, I think anyway, he and I are on a similar wavelength because I also liked how he debunked conspiracy theory kind of last time. I think this is related. It's about irrational fears, letting it, you know, kind of blow up in your head and take over. But I also felt like it's getting a little preachy. Like, it's almost like he's, next thing you know, he's going to start talking about politics or something.
I don't. Let's hope not. But
yeah, let's hope not.
Yeah. I don't know the exact saying, so I'm kind of paraphrasing a little bit, but isn't it something like one person isn't a threat, but like people are a threat, kind of like the mob in Rome, mm-hmm. you know, at the... And, you know, at the, you know, the gladiator arenas, you know, it's like one person, you know, can be completely irrational and be fearful. But when you get a group of people, that's when it's trouble. And that there was kind of a message about that earlier in the season too, talking about like the, you know, those strange ticks, how it spreads, you know, one person, it might be just one thing, but how it quickly spreads. And that was kind of like what happens here too, is it starts out little.
And this is about fear spreading. Yeah.
More. Right. And did you see what they were kind of talking about a little bit as they were going through that whole narration about, you know, how the fear spreads when you see the mom looking at the little boy reading the comic on the floor, and then it goes from just her and her concern mm-hmm. to the concern of many. And they were actually referencing, I think, a real thing, the public hearings about the comic books. Did you read up on that?
Mm-hmm. I already knew about it because I'm a huge comic nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the 50s, there was this psychiatrist, Frederick Wortham, who published this book called Seduction of the Innocents. And it's kind of infamous among comic fans because it was warning that comics were negative and they were corrupting young minds and they were a serious cause of juvenile delinquency. And it was like really taken seriously at the time. And so there were these U.S. congressional, you know, there was a U.S. congressional inquiry launched mm-hmm. into the comic book industry. And then the Comics Code Authority was formed. That was voluntary self-censoring of comic books. And there's this little symbol that I saw all as a kid on all the comics. And in the 2000s, I think starting in 2001, or at least Marvel Comics in 2001 got rid of that. And then it took all the way until 2011, but then DC got rid of it too. And now comics are much more interesting and they can be adult and have, but they were afraid for decades because of this. And looking back on it, to me, I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, you got to watch out what your kids get into, but this was a bit ridiculous. And it kind of reminds me of like the whole McCarthyism thing with trying to catch communists and just, you know, there's this whole cultural paranoia about something and everybody jumps on it.
Yeah, that was definitely before my time. But I mean, I think we've all, you know, just censorship in general. You know, I remember, you know, in my day, it was, you know, the PMRC and, you know, going against music. Do you remember the whole Parents Music Resource Center led by, I think it was Tipper Gore, and had the hearings against, you know, certain albums that they needed to be censored, and they ended up slapping like labels on some that they could, you know, contained content parental advisory stickers on record labels. And there was a congressional hearing about that. That was what I remember in my day for music.
Games too.
That's kind of what reminds me of that. Yeah.
Stuff that goes on with that. I don't know. I mean, it's not black and white, but it can just go too far.
It can't go too far.
But anyway, that all feeds into this whole moral panic idea.
Yep, sure does.
What's your number one?
Number one is, well, similar to what John Hamm, as our narrator throughout the season so far, asks, what have we learned? And a couple things that I had listed, not too many, but just a few things like what, and we talked about it, was what was under Fukuyama's basket. We got to see his face. Mm-hmm. So we saw that he is an older gentleman with scars and this type of, you mentioned this halo headgear. And he was not quite, I mean, he is kind of what you would think, but because we didn't know, you're left to interpret, but he just looked like an old scared man, you know, with scars and, you know, thinking that, you know, he could be just like an innocent victim as well. Whatever it was that happened to him that created him, you know, sounded pretty awful. So he just looked old and scared.
Yeah, what did they say? He had a computer or a machine transplanted into his head or something like that?
Yeah, and now he just is, you know, what he is, and they are him, and he created the Vermillion so he could communicate. So, but at least we got to see that, so it wasn't like the creepy, delusional bird chicken thing that we thought, you know, that we've been led to believe that he was evil. He's just a scared older gentleman. And and then we learn that David, to me, ? Because I don't know. I know that that's what they're alluding to, is the future threat that future Sid has been alluding to. Do we know for sure, though? I don't know. It was never spoken aloud, but they did show the silhouette of David to indicate that it's him.
It's him.
Yeah.
But I want to mention, too, while you're talking about Fukuyama, that fits in really good with this whole thing, because actually this was great timing for this, because throughout this whole time his face has been a mystery because he's had this wicker basket on his head and he's a little like creepy and weird, and he talks through these androgynous Vermilion, and they're kind of weird because they have mustaches, but they're women and they all have the same haircut. And that's the perfect target for this little delusion chick thing, because when you want to stoke fears, want to stoke moral panic, the target is going to be something that's unfamiliar, and because it's unfamiliar or unknown, it's going to be scary to people, and so they'll be more likely to jump to judgment if there's some fear stoked about it, right? And that's why I like all this counterculture stuff. Going to Burning Man, you see freaks everywhere and you get used to like being open to that and actually seeing the creativity in it. And that's why when I first saw these Vermilion, I was like, oh, that's awesome. I mean, there's a side of me that's like, oh, those are weird freaks. But there's another side that's like, hey, let your freak flag fly, you know? And so anyway, I just like that they held off on really letting us get to know Admiral Fukuyama or any of these Vermilion too much, so that they would have that creepy vibe to them, so that when this whole paranoia struck, I mean, I didn't know for sure until the end of the episode that they were actually not bad, that it was just this whole idea of moral panic at play.
Right. And it makes sense to make them a target because the unknown can be scary. So they are an easy target to make them seem like they are maybe not what they seem, or that they're maybe not all on the up and up because they are so mysterious, right? And there's not a lot known about Fukuyama or the Vermilion. So yeah, that makes them an easy target, I think. And it's really interesting to think about how, I don't know if anyone has seen the pictures of the actresses that play the Vermilion. They are these most beautiful, gorgeous women ever. And then you slap these really short, like they all have the same haircut, these wigs, and slap these mustaches on their faces, and they just look awful. They are not attractive at all.
Yeah, but what if they wanted to look like that? That's the thing, is, you know, it's culturally accepted for people to make themselves. I know they're not real, but in real life, you know, what if there was a girl who, oh, if you put her in a nice dress and beautiful makeup, then she would look so gorgeous, but now she looks awful. Well, what if she just wants to look like that? Then, you know, I think there should be more room for accepting things off the beaten path.
Oh, look, hey, I'm totally accepting of, you know, hey, I'm a freak, so I totally am supportive of whatever people want to do. I just think it's really interesting that they just look so androgynous.
Yeah.
At least in some way, at least for facial features, that they don't look very attractive. But whenever you see them without, you know, these wigs and just it's something so simple. That's all it takes, is just this wig and this mustache that they put on yeah, them to the make them seem so unattractive. Yeah, those porn stashes just don't do it for me. but hey, if that's what they chose to look like, then I'm all for it. If you choose to do that, I'm okay with it. I'm not being judgmental. I'm just saying it's just really interesting to see how attractive these women are. And I think that we get to see some of that because they're in those awesome body stockings. And man, are they rocking those body stockings when they're dragging Potonomy through the mainframe and they lean him up against that tree to hook him up. And they got some booty going in those body stockings, and they look pretty hot. But anyway, some other things that we learn, we talk a little bit about David. I think it's probably a pretty safe assumption that it's David, but I don't know that we can say it 100% because it wasn't said out loud. And I think at this point, I don't believe anything until I see it, or see it and believe it and believe it and see it, whichever way you want to go. And then we learn that the fear of a perceived threat can become a greater threat to reality than the focus of that fear. And I like that. And we already talked about that. So that was my number one, is just what have we learned?
Wait, say that again.
The fear of a perceived threat can become a greater threat.
That little moment where all the villagers focus on the viewer.
Yeah, that they are more of a threat than the actual fear itself.
Yeah, man. I totally believe that.
That's, I think, what we learn.
Yeah, the people hanging the witches, they're the ones to be afraid of.
Absolutely. The mob, I feel, is more fearful than what they're actually afraid of.
So my number one was Potonomy, which we already covered pretty well. Do you have any notes?
I have a couple notes. I thought it was interesting that it looks like it's not like an astral plane, but wherever they are, wherever Future Cid is, whenever the Shadow King, when Farouk visits her and when David visits her, it seems like their powers don't work there. She tells Farouk that you can't hurt me here. I hope you know that. And then Sydney touches David with no fear. Like, you know, they can kiss, oh, yeah, they yeah, can, yeah. you know, they can touch that. Skin to skin and nothing happens. So I just thought that was interesting that wherever they are, that their powers
maybe
don't
work.
Yeah,
on the astral plane. I mean, we know that Farouk doesn't have a physical presence, so it's probably on some mental plane.
Yeah, or it's in the orb that she was in,
right.
That Sydney's inside that orb. I guess if that orb is like a neutral territory, I have no idea. Some funny moments. I thought when Farouk left David in the astral plane, like you said, he left him at the kitty table. David in those schoolboy shorts and tall socks, I thought was just hilarious. I think we need to see more of that. I thought the image of him leaving Amy behind to laugh maniacally at David was just absolutely cruel and just another way to get to David in, you know, some way, whatever it is that Farouk is doing, whatever his plans are, was just another little attack, but I thought it was so cruel. I liked that we got to see female Carrie again. She was kicking some ass with the Vermilion. You know, we got to see her as we love her.
Yeah, except she was blowing them away because of her delusion, even though it turns out they were the good guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's not...
At least I think that's what it was.
Right, but they were regenerating.
Yeah, they're just machines, so I guess yeah, it's all right.
So, and then when Clark is walking down the hall and the Vermilion are following him and it's doing that little game of stop and go, the little voguing Vermilion.
Yeah, that was awesome. You can just picture them dancing, but you never got to see it because they're just frozen mid-vogue.
So that's all my notes.
Okay, mine, David, when he appeared in front of Botanomy, when Botanomy was about to shoot Admiral Fukuyama, and he goes, no! He's just so masterful with his powers now, teleporting it, and then he turned his gun into a broom. You mentioned he showed more powers. We don't know if he did that, or maybe he just made Botanomy think it was a broom, but either way, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, what else? Farouk, he refers to himself as the King of Shadows. I like that. It's like just a little turn of phrase, poetic way of saying it. Lenny, she's in a cell and it seems like she's kind of fucking around with Sid. Isn't it crazy? We were both inside David. but Sid doesn't believe that she's Lenny. You're just working for the Shadow King. And that made me doubt too, which is what the show does all the time. But it's like, oh, maybe that whole thing was a farce, or I don't know. Probably it is Lenny, because Lenny's known to have a kind of a sassy attitude.
I don't know what to think about Lenny, because it's like she knows more than what she's letting on. It's like one minute she acts like she knows nothing, and then the next minute she knows more than what she's saying. So I don't know what to think about her yet.
Yeah, you can't really trust her. But I do think it is Lenny. And she even admitted that she was sort of there working for Shadow King, but she also did want to visit David because they hadn't seen each other in a long time. She says Farouk raped her over and over again and kept her in the basement of his mind. And I don't even know if we can believe that, but it's possible. You know, we just don't know for sure. She could be trying to manipulate Sid, or she could have been telling the truth.
Yep, I don't know. Hopefully we find out.
All right, let's take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us. Okay, now it's time for the news.
Okay, news for this week. Just a couple of items that we have. The first item comes from avclub.com. So Noah Hawley has steadily been assembling a pretty stellar cast for Pale Blue Dot, his first feature film. We've talked about it a little bit already in some earlier news items in the podcast. So we already know Natalie Portman and John Hamm have signed on for the project. Well, it was announced this week that Dan Stevens, of course we know him as David Haller, has been added to the cast and will portray Portman's husband.
Nice.
So, yeah, super cool that we're going to get some additional Legion folks and some, you know, great casting.
I just hope it's not David Howley going, I'm sorry Legion got canceled, but I'm going to give you guys jobs.
Oh, no. Let's not think about that and just be positive.
All right.
At least that's what I'm hoping for anyway. I think it's a good thing. Always good to see people working. Next item is from express.co.uk. This was an interview with Navaad Nigaban, who plays Amal Farouk. So he was speaking a little bit about embodying the role that had previously been played by both Dan Stevens and Aubrey Plaza. So he says they provided the blueprint because they were possessed by the Shadow King in the first season. So when I came on board, I had to study their movements and their behaviors, and I tried to incorporate that into my work. He says, actually, both of them were very kind and generous with their time. They sat down and they talked about their journey and how they saw the character. So I just wanted to respect their take of the Shadow King and try to incorporate that into my work. I just hope that I do justice to it. Nigaban said, portraying Farouk on Legion was an amazing challenge. What I love about Legion is that it is a very intelligent show. It's a how that makes you question, or it's a show, sorry, that makes you question your every move and all the noises in your head. Nigaban agrees that the Shadow King's motivations stem from the fact that the audience only knows him through the character's interpretations. He adds, he has never been looked at who he is. Who he is, not what they say he is, will slowly be revealed.
Cool.
Yeah. That's it for the news.
Oh, that's it? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right, let's move on to mental notes. I'll go first. Steve Brown says, ostensibly on Legion, how many Davids are in his head? Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about that. And I think, yeah, these other voices seem to be getting stronger when David's off kilter, would you say?
Mm-hmm. I think there was just a, like, I think there was,
it's
like
his
David
voice.
One, David two. Yeah, yeah, it's his voice.
But they're saying, you know, hey, don't... you know, there's no reason to torture him. It's horrible. Or, but can we even hurt him here? So it sounds like they're not necessarily his friends, or they're kind of his friends, but they're debating it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just makes me wonder if they're preparing to move on to full, like, multiple personality schizoid David, which would be awesome. But yeah, they're all Dan Stevens, so I don't know.
If talking to yourself and having conversations with yourself means that you're schizophrenic, then I'm in trouble because I have conversations with myself.
And you're like, should I torture myself? No, that's mean.
Right.
He goes on, I find it hard to believe anything Farouk says. So if he says David ends up being the villain, I'm going to think the opposite. Potonomy sneaking around while others slept was creepy. Okay, voguing Vermilion was more creepy. And this episode, and this is just episode 7.
Right on.
I've got 4 more left.
Rory Toms says, David was always going to be the world killer Future Sid was referring to, I think. And Farouk just realized he may have been baiting a far superior power than his. But I'm probably wrong because this show is nuts. Mm-hmm. And so what the hell is the delusion from, if not Farouk? I don't know.
Yeah, it's just some random creature. That's what I think. Matt Heller random. Says, this episode was nuts. I would be thinking one thing and then they'd quickly pull the rug out from under me. I'm curious if this is the end of the monster chicken thing. It reminded me of the Brood creatures from the X-Men comics. Yeah, the Brood, classic alien creatures. I'm also wondering if they're intentionally trying to mislead us. It seems like the catalyst was the big bad. Then it seemed like the delusion monsters, or the Minotaur, or Fukuyama, or David himself. Are these important parts of the story, or just more delusions to distract us?
Distractions.
It's all distractions.
Yep. Laura Willie Swink says, always late with my feedback. Nope, you made it just in time, Laura. I liked the horror elements in this episode. When the Vermilion attacked Potonomy from beneath his sheets, that was straight out of The Grudge. And the inky delusion that sprouted out of his body in the finale was reminiscent of The Thing. Ooh, good throwback. But what was with the low-budget Jason and the Argonauts-style creature FX? Not quite up to par with the rest of the visuals on this show.
True.
Is it weird that I'll be angry if David sleeps with Future Sid? Does it make sense that Sid is jealous of her future self? Did David sleep with
future Sid?
That's
a good
Sid?
Question.
The moral dilemmas of time travel. And what's become of Potonomy? Is he a ghost in the shell now? Or just a fertilizer for a virtual sequoia?
I would say, because especially what we learned last episode, that, you know, see how different all the different Davids were just based on different things that happened in the timeline and how it forked off, because there's branches and branches and branches that, you know, this is a different Cid. So if he slept with her, then he's totally cheating on his girlfriend, especially when they had that discussion about ground rules. That's what I would say. What else did she say? I didn't see The Grudge. Did you?
Ugh, I did, and I'd rather forget it.
But The Thing, yeah, totally. And I agree about the effects, those little, when he plucked them out of the heads, it looked like a little Disney cartoon or something. Still a cool idea.
They are on a limited TV budget.
Yeah, here's a couple of emails. First one's from Heather Hildebrand, who says, "Hey guys, I was listening to last week's podcast where you were wondering if the shadows left behind after David's blasts were some sort of remnant of his powers or what else they might be. My first assumption was that they were nuclear shadows. The same appeared after the atomic bomb exploded in Hiroshima. Permanent shadows of people and plants left behind after the explosion on walls, stairs, and floors. I think they may have been trying to illustrate just how powerful his blasts are. Do a quick search for Hiroshima nuclear shadow. It's both fascinating and sad. From the website nowiknow.com, quote, a nuclear bomb explosion works in a similar way. The explosion acts as the sun does in the example above, except that instead of emitting UV rays, it emits thermal radiation. The radiation will bleach anything it ends up hitting, much like the UV rays cause sunburns. But anything that gets in the way, including a soon-to-be vaporized body, will soak up those rays, effectively shielding whatever is behind it from the bleaching effect. In a real sense, the dead acted as a form of nuclear sunblock, resulting in a shadow imprinted on objects behind them." I think that's interesting theory. Oh, it also says sent from my tricorder. Except that would mean that the rest of the ground would need to be bleached. And I don't think it was. I think you saw them standing there with their shadows behind them and then they were gone, but the shadows were still there and the rest of the ground was the same tone. I'd have to go back and watch for sure. Mm-hmm. But I do think still there might be something to what you're saying, that maybe somehow, yeah, the blast just sort of left an imprint of them behind or something.
Ugh, and now I'm depressed. That's awful.
I know. I get depressed thinking about just how many people died in those blasts. I mean, I wish there was another way that could have gone.
And kind of like how, well, and if it leaves some sort of like imprint of the people that it killed and obliterated, and how awful that was.
I know.
And then like it kind of reminds me of it. Yeah, and it's like Pompeii, you know, in Pompeii where the people that were killed in the blast of the volcano, like they're left behind there. Those you know, it's awful to think about.
There's volcanoes going off in Hawaii right now.
Yeah.
Spewing out.
Glad I'm not there right now.
I know. I flew over that volcano in a helicopter, but it wasn't blasting off like that.
It's really sad. Hopefully everyone is okay.
Yeah.
Next email.
Let's see if
is
this
from,
one's cheerier.
Yeah, well, she has a very cheerful name. This one's from Joy, so let's hope this is cheerful. She says, "Hello. I just wanted to let you know how much I'm enjoying the podcast and that past episode."
So far, so good.
Yeah, so good. But it was so emotionally draining that I had to join a Pomeranian Facebook group to look at cute puppy pictures. And I didn't say that I didn't want ice cream either. In the bald, paralyzed David universe, did he zap everyone in the world except his sister into non-existence? Or I don't know.
I thought it was the cops and their cars. In the immediate vicinity, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel it's so much is left to interpretation, and we don't know for sure.
That could have been the apocalypse right there.
Yeah, maybe that was it. I don't know. But I find that funny because I had to find something happy to do as well. I was just kind of crying and so emotionally drained and felt like the life had been kind of sucked out of me. That I had to do. I didn't join a Pomeranian Facebook group, but I did have to watch like a happy episode of something to just get my mind off of that. That was too much, which I think speaks a lot about Noah Hawley's writing.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Like I always say, I like to be moved.
Yeah.
All right, that is our show, episode 15. Thanks for listening, as usual, everybody. We're over the hump. We're heading in the downstretch.
We got 4 more episodes.
I know. I hope the season 3. I feel like there's going to be a season 3. I hope. If you want to get in touch with me and Rima, you can send us email or a voice message at legion@podcastica.com.
You can also find us on the web at facebook.com/legionpod.
I do the American Gods podcast, and the Facebook URL is my favorite. It's facebook.com/godpod.
Catchy.
And you can check us, but forget that. For you guys, facebook.com/legionpod. You can also check us out. You can find out about our other shows, including American Gods. And what else do we have going on over there? Strange Indeed.
Walking Dead cast.
Podcastica.com.
Lots of good stuff. Check us out.
All right. That's our show.
Thanks for listening.
Ugh. Spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.